From best-selling biographer Max Boot comes a revealing portrait of Ronald Reagan in the book Reagan, His Life and Legend, a portrait a decade in the making of the actor-turned-politician whose telegenic leadership ushered in a transformative conservative era in American politics. Despite his fame as a Hollywood star and television host, Reagan remained a man of profound contradictions, even to those closest to him. Max Boot is a historian and foreign policy analyst, is the Jean Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and a columnist for The Washington Post. Again, the name of the new book is Reagan, His Life and Legend, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Max Boot to the roundtable this morning. Max, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to Reagan as a subject matter and wanting to dedicate as much time and energy into telling this story?
Well, Reagan was an incredibly consequential president, not only to the country, but for me as well, growing up in the 1980s. But I observed about a decade ago when I was starting this book project that there was not a great biography of him out there. There were, to be sure, a lot of books about Reagan, but not really a definitive biographical treatment that looks at him objectively and with balance and perspective. And that's what I set out to do, to produce something that was neither a hagiography nor a hit job, but really an accurate and objective overview of Ronald Reagan with all his strengths as well as his weaknesses, his successes as well as his failures. And so I was very gratified to see in the New Yorker that they wrote that Reagan, His Life and Legend seeks to be the definitive biography, and it succeeds. So I kind of had a mission accomplished moment when I read that.
Why do you think it is, given his stature, given the reverence that so many people have for him and for his presidency, that there have not been more biographies of this man?
Well, there have been certainly some biographies, but nothing very objective and nothing that delves as deeply into his life as I do. And I think a lot of that just has to do with the passage of time, because that's been true with other presidents as well. It was only in the 1980s that we began to see, you know, good biographies of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who had been president, you know, more than 30 years earlier. So it just takes time, I think, to really understand a president's place. It also takes time to have archives open up and get a lot of new material, which I certainly did. But I was kind of lucky as well, not only to get new material out of the archives, but to do this at a point where there were still a lot of people who knew Reagan very well and who I was able to talk to, a lot of whom, you know, no longer around, like George Shultz, Colin Powell, and a number of others no longer around, but I was lucky enough to talk to him. So is that really that combination of being able to talk to the people who really knew him and being able to search through the archives and being able to also gain that kind of distanced, objective perspective that I think is why this book was possible now.
You mentioned those that worked with him, his aides, as well as family members that you got to talk to. But in talking about the research and specifically what was available to you through the archives, what was newly available and what really became very crucial for you in telling the story?
Well, there was an awful lot of documentation from the National Security Archives, including things like transcripts of all of Gorbachev's meetings with Reagan, their summits. So before, you know, you had a general idea what happened, but now I could actually sit down and read exactly what they said, what these two leaders said to one another, including not just when they were negotiating, but even when they were having dinner and in lighter social moments. So that really provides kind of a crucial texture to understand their critical relationship. And that's, you know, that's only one small part of it. There was an awful lot of new information about White House infighting. I was able to also read all of Reagan's letters and even to see documents that he had at his desk when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And there's just a million things that provide critical clues to his personality and to his record. And you kind of have to put all that together into the grand narrative, which is what I spent a decade doing.
Talk a little bit about his upbringing. And coming from the Midwest and growing up the way he did, to then think that acting would be the profession that he wanted to enter.
Well, certainly Hollywood stardom was a very far-fetched idea for Reagan when he first began to entertain that notion after having been high school and in college thespian. I mean, he grew up in small town Illinois. His family was very poor. His father, an alcoholic shoe salesman, that kept moving from one town to another. Even going to college for Reagan seemed like quite a stretch because very few people went to college in those days, in the late 20s and early 30s. But he managed to go to Eureka College and then graduated in 1932 in the midst of the Great Depression, the worst economic downturn in U.S. history. And there is one of the, I write in the book about one of the great might-have-beens of American history, because in 1932, there was a new Montgomery Ward that was opening up in Reagan's hometown of Dixon, Illinois. And he applied for the job of manager of the athletic goods department, for which he was certainly qualified, having been a high school and college athlete. And if he'd gotten that, he might very well have stayed in Dixon his whole life, and we would have never heard of Ronald Reagan. But as it happens, he didn't get that job, and so he had to look around elsewhere and wound up getting a job in radio in Davenport, Iowa, and then quickly moving to Des Moines, where he became a very well-known sportscaster and the voice of the Chicago Cubs. And then in 1937, when the Cubs were visiting Catalina Island off the coast of California for their spring training, Dutch Reagan, as he was then known, went with them and snuck away to Warner Brothers to do a screen test and wound up being hired. And so that was his very improbable path from small town poor boy in the Midwest to Hollywood star. And that was, of course, the celebrity he achieved there, what catapulted him to the next stage as governor and ultimately president.
Ultimately, what was it about him, do you think, about his makeup, his personality, that lent himself to not only be successful in film and as an actor, but on the radio as an announcer and doing broadcasts, doing baseball broadcasts?
Well, he had a great ability to communicate, and it wasn't just that he was good at reading speeches, although he was certainly very good at reading speeches. But, you know, in those days and for decades afterwards, he didn't have speechwriters. He had to make up his own commentary, and he was very quick on his feet. You know, he was very quick with a quip. He was very good at describing action on the field, even when he wasn't actually seeing it, because in those days, you know, he was calling baseball games based on reports on the telegraph of what was happening, and he was just envisioning the action in his own mind without actually seeing it. But he was able to conjure up this very vivid picture for viewers, and he never lost that ability. He always had a tremendous ability to communicate, in part inspired by his boyhood hero, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he was certainly influenced, like so many Americans were, by listening to FDR and his fireside chats, a very intimate, very simple way of speaking that resonated very powerfully with Americans. And that was, you know, a style of communications that Reagan also picked up, and that's what really made him the master communicator.
Give us a sense of, you read in the book, there is a chapter titled Fort Wacky, and you write about his war service. Give us a sense about that. He's in Hollywood at this point as war breaks out. What happens?
He goes into the Air Force, but he never goes very far from home because he served in World War II in Culver City, California, just a few miles from his home, working at an old movie studio that was converted into the base of the Air Force's first motion picture unit. And so he spent the entire war basically making training and propaganda films. But the movie magazines made it sound like he was thousands of miles away at the front when he would show up at events in town and they would talk about, you know, Ronald Reagan back from the front. And it kind of gave a deceiving impression that he was actually involved in combat, which he certainly was not. But, you know, he played a role similar to many other kind of rear echelon soldiers and doing his duty, but doing it very far from harm's way.
And obviously that stayed along, that image stayed around for a long time, including when he ran for president. But as you say in the book, that he cannot, of course, be held responsible for the content of fan magazines.
Yes, but I would say he certainly gave a deceptive impression himself, because he later wrote about how, you know, after the war, he was so happy to come home and make love to his wife, and he had seen enough killing to last a lifetime and wanted to build a better world. And, you know, none of that was strictly speaking a lie, but it was certainly gave an inaccurate impression that he had been away to the front, because he never left the country during the war.
You write about his time in dealing with the Hollywood blacklist, and I'm curious as to how that came about, and was that, it seems in my reading that was a bit of bringing him into some political context at that point.
Yeah, that was really the start of his experience in politics, and really his entry onto the national stage. When he was in the late 40s, he was a labor leader in Hollywood. He became president of the Screen Actors Guild. He testified before the House American Honor Affairs Committee. He was very active in Hollywood politics. And of course, the big political controversy was over the activities of communists in Hollywood. There were a bunch of fervent red hunters who claimed that there was a Kremlin conspiracy to take over Hollywood. I found in my own research that this was vastly exaggerated and not really accurate, but Reagan believed it. And so he thought that he was stopping this communist takeover of Hollywood. And he became very active in administering the Hollywood blacklist, which was, you know, the list of people who were suspected communists whose careers were basically destroyed. So, yeah, he played a very active role in post-war Hollywood politics. And that was kind of a segue for him from a movie career into a larger political role in general.
I mean, a lot was made, and we still talk about it, of how Reagan was a Democrat. What brought him into the Democratic Party? What brought him to leave the party?
That's a great question. And Reagan himself gave a somewhat, you know, deceiving account of it, because he often said, "I didn't desert my party. My party deserted me," you know, to imply that Democrats had gone sharply to the left. But that's not really true, because his conversion occurred in the 1950s, when the Democrats were actually pretty conservative. In fact, in 1960, John F. Kennedy ran to Richard Nixon's right on defense policy. So it wasn't really the Democrats who had changed. It was Reagan. And he moved away from his earlier New Deal enthusiasm and support for the Democrats. And I think there were a variety of reasons he did that, beginning with the fact that during World War II, as a highly paid Hollywood actor, he didn't enjoy paying 90% rates of income taxation, which was the top rate at the time. Then, as we were discussing, in the late 40s, he got involved in anti-communist politics in Hollywood. That made him a very hardline anti-communist. And then finally, in the 1950s, when his movie career was basically over, he got a new job working for General Electric as host of GE Theater, this nationally televised show, but also as a spokesman for GE. And GE in those days was a very right-wing company. They actively proselytized their employees with right-wing materials, because they thought this was a way to protect themselves from labor activity and strikes. And so Reagan really imbibed a lot of this right-wing propaganda that GE was foisting on its employees. And I think that really completed his transformation from New Deal Democrat to very conservative Republican by the early 1960s.
When it came time to run for political office, how set were his political beliefs?
I mean, he was certainly set in his political beliefs. He was quite conservative, quite far to the right by the time he ran for his first political office in 1966 as governor of California. You know, he campaigned against radicals in Berkeley, against disorder and crime, and focusing on the Watts riot in 1965. And he came across as quite right-wing, opposed civil rights legislation. But, you know, people who bought that image were surprised by how he acted once in office, because it turned out that his record as governor was actually had a lot in common with the record of the Democrat that he defeated, Pat Brown. Reagan wound up increasing state spending and state taxes. He signed the most liberal abortion law in the country and a tough gun control bill. He added a lot of acres to the state's parks and increased funding for higher education. So his record actually turned out to be much more centrist and pragmatic. And he showed a willingness to make deals with Democrats that, you know, that caught a lot of people, both supporters and critics, off guard.
You write in the book, Ronald Reagan would soon find that most of the issues that came across his desk as governor had neither simple nor easy solutions. His early days in office would amount to a crash course in the substantial differences between campaigning and governing. Even finding a place to live would turn out to be harder than it looked. Was he qualified for the job?
Well, in some ways, you would have to say no. He wasn't qualified, because he had no real management experience when he became governor of California, which was already the nation's most populous state. And he had very little knowledge of state government. I mean, his political interests were primarily focused on fighting communism and larger issues. He didn't know about kind of bread and butter issues in California. And so, as he himself later admitted, he had a steep learning curve once he got into office. It took him a while to get the hang of it, basically. And he didn't like living in Sacramento, didn't like schmoozing with legislators. So there was a lot to learn, but he actually improved tremendously and really got the hang of the job, such that I interviewed Jerry Brown, who was his successor as governor and also son of Pat Brown, the man that Reagan beat in 1966. I asked Jerry Brown, you know, what did you think of Reagan as governor? And he told me, I thought Reagan was a pretty good governor. I mean, you don't expect to hear that from a Democrat, but that was what Jerry Brown told me. And I think that was a general feeling in Sacramento that Reagan figured out the job after a slow start.
You write in that chapter that he himself conceded that he made lots of mistakes because of inexperience, but also that on-the-job training would prove, as you point out, painful, but ultimately much more successful than his detractors would have thought.
Right, and he became a very popular governor with a lot of bipartisan support, such that, you know, by the early 1970s, he was seriously thinking about a presidential campaign, and he was one of the leading Republicans in the entire country. So, you know, he had initially a rocky transition from acting to politics, but he proved a natural at the political game.
At what point did he start thinking about running for president, that was something that he wanted to do?
Well, at a pretty early stage. I mean, it's kind of interesting because he won the governorship of California in November 1966. And a few weeks later, he was already convening a meeting with his advisors to talk about a presidential campaign in 1968. And he did run in 68, but failed to take the Republican nomination away from Richard Nixon and then kind of pretended it never happened. And then after that, he thought that, you know, Richard Nixon would serve two terms, leave office in 1976, and Reagan thought he would be the natural successor to Nixon, who he strongly supported. So Reagan was very unpleasantly surprised when in 1974, in the middle of Watergate, Nixon had to resign and Gerald Ford became president. And so Reagan felt like Ford was kind of a usurper who was not the rightful president, not the rightful leader of the Republican Party. And so in 1976, Reagan did something that shocked a lot of Republicans. He challenged Ford for the Republican nomination, and he actually came pretty close to unseating him and just fell short, but then set himself up to be the frontrunner for the Republican nomination in 1980.
Talk a little bit about the race in 1980, ran against George Bush and others, and that was... How close were those elections? Because obviously there was great strife in the country with hostages and the economy and a lot of problems facing the Democratic Party as well as the incumbent Jimmy Carter.
Reagan really took advantage of Carter's declining popularity because of the Iran hostage crisis, because of high inflation, hot gas lines, you know, weak economic growth. Carter just seemed mired in failure. And so Reagan had an opening to seek the presidency in 1980. But it was at first a fairly close race because even though people weren't necessarily happy with Carter, a lot of Americans had doubts about whether this former actor was qualified to be president. But then Reagan... really cleaned Carter's clock in their one presidential debate where Reagan deployed that famous line, "There you go again," when Carter called him out correctly for having opposed Medicare and Medicaid. And then, you know, things kind of swung Reagan's way. And so he put to rest doubts about whether he was up to the job of the presidency and won the election by a pretty large margin when the vote finally occurred.
You talk in the book about how Ronald Reagan reinvented himself many times, and he was a three-time presidential candidate, and Then at 69 years old, he takes on this post as president of the United States. And what you have a line in here, which I thought was interesting, about the previous four presidents were seen as failures. That was what he was walking into.
Yeah, the job seemed pretty much impossible at that stage, given all the problems that Johnson, Nixon, and Ford had encountered. And I think Reagan's greatest asset was that he made the difficult look easy. He never seemed to break a sweat. He seemed undaunted by the challenge, and he always projected optimism and good cheer. And I think that was something Americans were really ready for after the turmoil and troubles of the 1970s. They wanted somebody who would make them feel good about themselves and about the country, and that was certainly Ronald Reagan.
When it comes to the administration that he started to build and gather, give us a sense of that process and what he was looking for in people who would serve in his cabinet, serve in his administration.
Well, a lot of the selection of people to run cabinet agencies and other departments, a lot of that was really delegated by Reagan. As he didn't do a lot of active management. He delegated a lot of things, including selecting, you know, senior appointees, a lot of whom turned out to be duds. There were quite a number of them were ensnared in scandals or otherwise proven incompetent. But he got one big thing right, or at least one big thing right, which was his choice of White House chief of staff. And he chose Jim Baker, who turned out to be one of the best White House chiefs of staff in history. And that was a very unusual and unexpected choice, because Jim Baker had worked for Gerry Ford in 1976 and for George H.W. Bush in 1980, in both cases, you know, trying to deny Reagan the nomination. So normally presidents, when they choose a White House chief of staff, they appoint some crony. They don't appoint their opponent's campaign manager, but that's exactly what Reagan did. And it was a very pragmatic decision. It disappointed Ed Meese, who had been Reagan's chief of staff in Sacramento and thought he was going to get the job in Washington. But Reagan, Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan understood that Meese wasn't really up to the job, and they thought that Baker was, and that proved correct. That was a brilliant appointment that made up for the weakness of a lot of other nominees.
Al Haig, Caspar Weinberger, part of that first cabinet, bitter rivals to Reagan.
Yes, this was part of a pattern where Reagan's aides were often feuding with one another, and he didn't sort it out, and he kind of let them continue with their infighting. And certainly that was the case with Cap Weinberger, the defense secretary, and Al Haig, the first secretary of state. And then even when Al Haig was fired in 1982 and replaced by George Shultz and Cap Weinberger also couldn't stand each other. They were constantly at each other's throats. And, you know, at one point, Bud McFarlane, who was the national security advisor, said, you know, Mr. President, you need to make a choice. We're just paralyzed by having both Cap and George in the cabinet. You need to choose one and tell the other guy to leave. And Reagan said, well, you know, sorry, bud, they're both my friends. You just have to work it out. And so Reagan really shied away from interpersonal conflict and really did not want to make those hard choices.
What was his relationship with his vice president, George Bush?
It was pretty remote. They were not friends by any stretch. They got along perfectly fine. They had weekly lunches together, but in 8 years of the Reagan presidency, George and Barbara Bush were never invited to the family quarters of the White House, and Barbara Bush and Nancy Reagan couldn't stand each other. They just had a mutual loathing, whereas George Bush and Ronald Reagan got along fine. But again, they weren't super close, because Reagan was basically not super close to anybody other than Nancy.
What was it about of then being a part of an administration that, by all accounts, is in its first 4 years successful, or certainly successful enough to be reelected in 1984?
What was it that made him successful enough to be reelected?
Yes, and working with that cabinet and working with those individuals of making it a successful cabinet.
Well, a lot of it, what made the first administration successful, was actually outside of Reagan's hands, because a lot of the hard lifting of reviving the economy was done by Paul Volcker, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who hiked interest rates, which caused the terrible recession from 81 to 83, but also wrung inflation out of the economy and set the stage for a very strong economic rebound in 1984. And Reagan always had impeccable timing, and he got very lucky with the timing of the business cycle, because in 1984, the economy came roaring back from a terrible recession to grow by over 7% in 1984. That was very strong growth, and that really propelled him towards re-election, running on a Morning in America theme, basically touting the fact that the country was better off than it had been 4 years earlier. And that message really resonated, and Reagan had a lot of bipartisan appeal. And at the end of the day, he won 49 out of 50 states, which is, you know, impossible to imagine any political figure today winning 49 out of 50 states, but he did, and that showed how popular he was, and in part because he had such a winning approach that so many people liked. He kind of charmed the nation, but also because, you know, any president's reelection is really based on the economy, and in Reagan's case, the economy was doing very well in 1984.
Does he deserve the term the great communicator?
Absolutely. That was one of his great gifts. And it wasn't just, as I said earlier, it wasn't just an ability to read scripts or to read speeches. He really knew how to craft an argument and how to convey that argument to people. In fact, Stu Spencer, who was one of his closest aides, his campaign manager, going back to 1966, told me that Reagan was not only the best speech giver he ever met, but also the best speech writer. That, you know, long before he entered the White House, he wrote his own speeches. He wrote them on index cards, and he was very good at judging what worked with an audience and what didn't. And so, you know, index cards that worked stayed in the pile. Those that didn't work got tossed out. And so he really figured out how to hone his speeches to a very high degree of communication ability, with great one-liners and anecdotes, and really captured people's attentions. He really knew how to talk to people.
When you look at his legacy and how he is viewed now, what do you think he would make of the current state of the Republican Party?
He would probably be somewhat befuddled by it, because remember, Reagan was pro-immigration, pro-trade, pro-alliance, pro-NATO, pro-standing up to Russian aggression. And in all those ways, he's very different from a lot of today's Republican leaders. And fundamentally, Reagan was a very sunny, optimistic guy who talked about America as a shining city on a hill. So I think he would be somewhat puzzled by the kind of dour message that you hear from Republicans today about how America is supposedly a failing nation. Those words would never come out of Ronald Reagan's mouth. And in fact, I suspect if he were still alive, he would be denounced by a lot of today's Republicans as a rhino, as a Republican in name only, because he was, you know, so different from where the party is today.
And yet, for those, even some of those same Republicans who are running now, have reverence and revere Ronald Reagan.
Absolutely, and you've seen that with an enthusiastic turnout for the Reagan movie, which got bad reviews, but drew a lot of people, you know, to the movie theater. A lot of Republicans, in particular, who have a lot of nostalgia and affection for Ronald Reagan. I mean, the irony is that when Reagan took over in 1980, that was, you know, Reaganism represented a right turn for the Republican Party and for the country. But today, if the Republican Party embraced Reaganism, it would be moving to the left. It would be returning to the center. And so we'll have to see if that happens. But certainly on the issues, Reagan was not nearly as far to the right as the party is today.
The name of the new book is Reagan, His Life and Legend by Max Boot, Pulitzer Prize finalist. The book is published by Liberite. And Max, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for a great discussion. Really appreciate it.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Reagan, His Life and Legend. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.